in January the bees will be maybe around 10,000 in the hive. You'll have a queen, one queen, about 10,000 female bees, workers. They'll be clustered, so they'll be in a tight ball, and they'll eat their stores. You've left them enough honey for the winter. They eat that, and they then shear that to keep warm, so they generate their own heat.
Yeah.
So they're quite self-sufficient as long as they've got enough food. So that's been true. And then about February, the queen will start laying eggs. And so, very slowly, the nest will start to expand, depending on the weather. March to April, the nest will be expanding more, and so you get more new bees being born.
Yeah.
Towards the end of April, May, the bees may be strong enough that they may get up to 60,000-70,000 to, in the natural order of things, they would propagate. So when they're very, very strong, they might think about splitting, which is when they swarm. So swarming is just basically propagation, colony propagation and reproduction. So you could, it's very parallel to the life of a plant or a tree, you know. Trees grow and then they produce the leaves and flowers and they propagate and then you get the seeds. Probably July is the main honey, what used to be in this country, it's actually slipped earlier now. June, July would be the main, what we call honey flow, where most of the bees would collect the most food. And obviously food that they don't need for the nest would get stored for the winter. Bees are basically the hoarders and that's all excess food. You know, there's a lot of them, they work very cooperatively. As a baby bee is born, she'll move, this is very simplified, through a sequence of jobs. And it seems very altruistic, it's actually based on pheromone communication, but each bee is working for the good of the colony, basically. And they're all one big family. There's one queen who's the mother of all of them. So it only really works because they've got like a genetic... they share the same genes, basically. And then from, say, August through to November, the colony will start getting smaller again. So you can always see it like this, the colony population will do this. So it gets smaller again, and then they'll go down to about 10,000 or so for the winter. The main difference between them and, say, bumblebees is that honeybees, you could say, were perennial. They don't hibernate, but they have like a diapause where they last the winter and then they flourish again in spring. So you can see lots of parallels with plants.
Is there any, you talk about altruism and things like that, is there any way in which you could say that there's intelligence in our life? What form is that?
Bees' brain is that size of the brain of millet, but it's very well developed. It's most developed of all insects, I think. They've actually got memory. They can learn tasks. They can actually learn a task in one situation and apply it to a different situation. They have a highly complex communication system, which is mostly based on pheromones, so that bees either releasing a smell or a gas or being received by the bees. But I would say most of the bee colony is usually called a super organism now. And the whole thing is that there's all these individual creatures all gathering or simulating information, but then they're sharing the information and then acting together.
Yeah. And could you argue that the super organism has an intelligence that's not? More than the sum of the parts of the different bees.
Definitely. There's not an emotional thing there. It's easy to get emotional about your bees. I get very emotional about them, but they don't recognise you. They're not like a domestic animal. They don't. I'm thinking of writing a book about called How to Love Your Bees, but I know that they'll never love me back. It's just, yeah, there is a shared intelligence. It's because everything is shared, information is shared and communicated. They've got the waggle dances where they communicate how to get to the...
As I was saying earlier, the hives do have very particular personalities.
Yeah, they do. Each hive does have a personality, depending on the queen. Usually, she seems to be the. The queen has pheromones, which she gives out all the time, which the bees share amongst themselves. And it seems to be, if she gives out a lot of pheromones, the bees are very cool and chilled and nice to handle. And if she's a bit short on the pheromone, then they can be a bit crabby. But they do all have different, even each individual, you could even say each individual bee has a character, but it's a genetic character.
Yeah.
And I guess nurture comes into it as well. There's nature and nurture, but it's not, I don't think you could say they had an emotional type of character.
Mm. Interesting. Just talk me through, the threats to the bee population.
There's lots of threats. I mean, the biggest threat in this country at the moment is Varroa, which is a parasite, which is our fault. It's a parasite. It's a mite which jumped host from the Asian, one of the Asian honeybees, Apis serrana, because of people importing bees and exporting bees that come to this country.
Yeah. And what, and that would be to do with commercial.
Yeah.
Production or
people just importing bees. I think European honeybees exported because they're better honey producers. So yeah, it all just comes down to greed, really, or trade. And maybe there's been some ESM coming back, but basically the European honeybee hasn't evolved to cope with the parasites, so it's been devastating in this country. And no chemical. Nothing will get rid of it. All you can do is try and control it or help bees deal with it. But certainly with a lot of the other diseases that bees can get, they're very much like us. If they're stressed, they will get twits. They'll get one of the flowers. Most of the bees have got most of the diseases lying dormant, but if they get stressed, and they can get nutritionally stressed, or they can be stressed by moving them, or they can be stressed by clumsy handling, then they can become susceptible to quite a lot of diseases and pathogens.
Mm. Mm. And the colony collapse disorders?
Well, I think it's the straw that broke the donkey's back. I think it's a whole mix of things. I mean, I'm not a scientist, but moving bees and pushing them too hard. A bee's like a car. If you push it, if it flies a lot, then it will wear out. So if they're really, really pushed, like if they start them off in the almond pollination in February and they work them right through till August or something, by the time they get there, they're knackered, they're worn out.
Yeah.
You know, they can't replace each other quick enough.
So when you say start them, what does that
they
mean?
They get them artificially strong. They feed them early, build up the brood nest. They feed them protein so that the brood nest gets big, so that they're a strong community to pollinate the almonds. Because not many other insects will be working at that time of year, February. Then you've got herbicides and pesticides. And I don't know if the neonicotinoids are responsible by themselves, but I'm sure that a cocktail of chemicals in the hive can react in ways that we don't know about. There's lack of forage in some places. I mean, even a period of rain can be quite stressful for bees because they're kind of confined in the hive, and you can get carbon dioxide build up
inside
the hive. Yeah, they can't get out.
Poor ventilation.
Poor ventilation. They can't get out for a poo. It all adds up.
Yeah.
So I think it's a combination of things: colony collapse and the bees just, you know, reach a point where they can't cope and there's too many things all at once.
Mm.
And it's a lot to do with people pushing them too much and expecting too much. Even the breeding bees to have larger nests, to store more, to swarm less. Bees have got ways of, you know, have always had ways of coping,
natural. Bees are very flexible and adaptable, but I think we've made the world move on faster than they can.
Right, I see. So we haven't changed the bees so much as we've changed their environment.
Absolutely.
So again, just sort of paint me the doomsday scenario. You know, what happens? What happens to us? What happens to agriculture? I won't say, you know, without any bees, because there will be bees. But if, you know, if things take a turn for the worse, what could?
One of the reasons that honeybees are very, very important for pollination. Pollination is their main role. Is their sheer numbers, and that's why they use them in almonds. They're actually technically probably not the best pollinators, but there's more of them. You know, bumblebees are 100 or so in a nest, and then they're solitary bees, and there's other pollinating insects, but honeybees you get in a, you know, 50,000, 60,000, 70,000.
Right.
Plus they're ready early in the year, much earlier than most, and that's one of the main reasons why they're important pollination.
Yeah.
And if you don't get pollinated, then of course you don't get fruits, nuts,
yeah,
new plants.
I mean, this is something that, you know, I only pick up from, you know, articles in newspapers and things like that. So there are other insect pollinators.
Yeah, but also the other insect pollinators, their habitat has disappeared. So there's fewer of them.
So in a sense, this again has echoes to me of conversations about climate change and carbon dioxide is a marker gas. You know, it stands as a proxy for all the other greenhouse gases as well. So it sounds like, you know, saying a similar thing, that if the bee population is threatened, then all the other insect pollinators will be as well.
Yeah. But also it's their sheer numbers that makes them a really important part of pollination.
Yeah.
And also the other thing they do, which other insect pollinators don't, is a bee will tend to forage on one foraging fruit. She'll tend to forage on the same plant. So she's not taking foreign pollen to a different plant with no chance of it pollinating. She goes on dandelions, she'll stay on dandelions. And so therefore the pollen of dandelions will be taken to dandelions, or pollen of pears will be taken to pears. And so that may, you know, where a butterfly might go to a dandelion somewhere else, say hellebore or something else, so the pollination is going to be much more accidental. Because with bees it's more efficient, so it's called constancy, flower constancy. And the other thing is that their communication system is so good that their pollination is going to be less random, because, you know, the bee finds a good forage place, goes back, tells the others all the bees are there.
Yeah.
You know, so it's much more efficient because of the communication system.
Mm-hmm. Okay. And what's the future then for bees and beekeeping? And
like I said before, I think lots more small beekeepers, urban beekeeping, maybe people looking at the way we do, it has happened in some ways, the way that we farm. I mean, there are schemes where farmers can get grants to put, like, wide open fields with seafaring, and all that kind of stuff helps. Sure. But I think we should think about honey as a very precious thing, and not push the bees so hard, and also think about the welfare of the bees more. You know, it's more important that we help them through the crisis and help them be more self-sufficient. It's like anything, if you breed cows to produce more milk, they don't last as long, and they're much more, they're just that one thing, aren't they?
Yeah.
And it's the same with honeybees. You can breed bees that will give you lots and lots of honey, but they're the ones that are going to collapse more quickly. They're the ones going to be less hardy and less adaptable, because you in selecting one thing have a good quality.
Mm.
Genetic diversity is really important.
What about the different species of beings, like genetic diversity? How does that map out on the countryside? Are all the bees in this country basically one?
It's
like one genus.
Well, do you mean honeybees?
Yeah.
There's quite a big gene pool, especially in Devon. Basically, you got Apis mellifera, and then people have the imported bees. There's a lot of Italian bees, or Carniolan bees, or New Zealand bees. But imports are stopping now because of the obvious risks. But I think there is a good genetic pool in this country because there's so many beekeepers.
Right. So you get to see the local
diversity. Most of the mating, the reason why the genetic is so good is the queen is the only one that will mate in hive, mates with 10 to 20 drones. So you've got a wide genetic palette. I mean, the bees have got it built into them. That's what they do, is have as many genes as possible. In America, their gene pool is very small, which is why they're, another reason why they're having problems. They've got very, very small gene pool, because you've got big queen rearers who breed from two narrow lines, and they're going to get inbreeding quite quickly. Whereas here, there's so many beekeepers, and the bees have got quite a big genetic pool, and they're outbreeding all the time.
Yeah.
So hopefully it's keeping healthy.
So it's almost like the answer to issues with bee stocks in the country is to work on a local scale.
I think the answer to keep the bees alive is, for anyone, is to learn about the bees and work with them, not against them. The bees work the way they are, it's got a purpose. And going against them, which lots of beekeepers do, is counterproductive in the end, and it's why we've got all the problems. So you have to think like a bee and see, understand why the mechanisms are in place.